Hi, I'm Tom Leininger, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Well, we haven't started a session yet without starting with a serenity prayer. Would you help me open the meeting with a serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Well, this is that time of all IDAA meetings where Luke gets his chance to talk. It's always called Luke's Lament. For those of you who have never been to an IDAA meeting, you will find out why it's called Luke's Lament. We've never been able to find another secretary, and that is Luke's Lament. He'll talk to you about it, but he's only kidding. I give you Luke R.
Thank you, Tom. I'm Luke, and I'm an alcoholic. You'll notice, perhaps, my identification. This was a tribute paid by the Washington group last year. The group in Washington put this on me when I got there. If those in the back can't see it, it says, Godfather. This was given as a tribute to my humility. And I wear it around the house about 10, 15 minutes every morning just to continue my recovery. I'm not going to qualify myself. I'm eminently qualified as an alcoholic, so I don't think I'll take you through any of that. The congressional record carries about 45 minutes of my testimony before Harold Hughes, in which I told enough that there wasn't any doubt about my identity in this organization. So we'll skip that. They only gave me 15 minutes now, so I can't take the time to give you the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I ordinarily do, nor can I give you the detailed history of the IDAA. But there are over 70 who are here for the first time to this group. And so I'm going to try in a very short time to get a few ideas across to you about the texture, structure, and so on of this particular group. We are sort of a queer organization in that we are an Alcoholics Anonymous group, and we're listed in the directory of Alcoholics Anonymous as a special group. We were one of the first so listed, and for many years, some 18 or 20, it's been listed with my telephone number as the contact point in Youngstown, Ohio, for this organization. I really think I'm lucky to have been forced into or fallen into or whatever to become secretary, because, as my good wife says, it's the one thing that keeps you sober. You're so damn busy you don't have time to pour. And she's been a great help to me, and through the years she's not well and is not with us at this meeting. But I've had a lot of help and a lot of support, and before I go any further, I want to be sure and pay tribute to this very fine group in Cleveland. It's a well-organized, structured group, and they've been going for a long time, and when they put in a bid to do this job, which you see is so well done here, I was happy. It was promising, and I think they're doing a superb job of putting the details together. Those of you who've never done it, I'm sure don't realize that they're going through it. Dave and Tom and all of the Jay, all of them and their wives, and the probably 30 or 35 of them have taken a very active part in this. And it's not easy. They've had a lot of meetings. They've done a lot of sifting and shifting and so on to pick and select the places, the food, and so on. We always have some mistakes. We always have some errors. That goes with the par for the course setup. And yet, I think it's been a very good meeting, and I want you all to give us a hand for the committee. It's a real job, and I will say one thing in that connection. I know a lot of the women would like to go to other places. There are alluring and bewitching spots where they would like to go for this meeting. But we have to keep in mind that the meeting must be centrally located where it's easy to reach and not too expensive. We have all these matters to consider, but primarily we've got to have a competent group or an interested, devoted group inside you who can plan the meals and make all these arrangements. There are hundreds of telephone calls occurring before, in the several weeks and months before this meeting, before they get the thing put together. And it is a real job, and again I say it's those who have been chairman in previous years and have put the meeting together, I think have been rewarded with their own satisfaction of doing a good job. We've had very good luck. Our meetings have always been successful. And as I say, we're kind of an odd group, and GSO has sort of had to adjust itself to our existence. I think we're probably the largest special group. I have over 2,250 addressograph plates. These are constantly changing. My secretary has to change. Throw out some and make some new ones almost every day or every other day because people die and new ones come in and new applications for information about the organization are coming constantly, so that this is a big and a shifting population that, from my viewpoint, of course, I've always hoped and wished I might be able to put some statistics together on it because there are some shocking pieces of information that I get, but I don't have scientific records, computer records. I can't get enough information to really ever put together a very comprehensive idea. Every time I send a mailing, and this is over 2,000, I get maybe 30, 40 of them back. They're returned with no forwarding address, or once in a while it'll be deceased, or no longer at this address. So I get all types of responses, and in passing, I'd like to remind you that when you move, for heaven's sake, let us know. I can't read your mind, and there's hardly any way I can find you if you're in a small town. I don't know how to get a hold of you if you move your office. Now, the post office is pretty independent. If you move two doors down the hall and you change your office number to 264 from 254, the buggers will send it back to me and say you're no longer there. So keep that in mind in your own cases and then for other people that you're interested in and whose names you send. Another simple matter I'd like to mention. I'd like to know what kind of a doctor it is. When you send in someone's name, a friend or a neighbor who needs some help, don't send it just as doctor. He may be a dentist, he may be a podiatrist, he may be a vet, he may be a psychologist. We have taken the attitude over the years that any doctor in the health care business has a right, if he wishes, to come to this organization. As you know, it's like AA. We have no pledges, no dues, no obligations, whatever. These are things that I'm rambling over, but try to get some ideas to you in a hurry. Anyone who has not, at some time, filled out this little form that we send out to every new name we get, and many of you, the new ones, have filled them out here. But what this is a little record for us, the name, the age, the spouse, home address, office address, telephone numbers, your degree, whether it's MD, DO, DDS, PhD, or otherwise, type of practice or specialty, whether or not you're affiliated with AA, are you or are you not? And if you haven't decided, we'll settle for a question mark. We assume that many of you are still shopping and making up your mind, and we're not going to be snooty about that. There's quite a few here who didn't know whether they were or weren't either in AA or anyplace else when we first. It's very comforting to sit up here and see some some recovered dead people who, who, for all practical purposes, were non-compass and non-entity a few years ago when they first came around. I've had a lot of exciting, maybe it isn't exciting to you, but I'm that sort of a queer person who gets excited about seeing people stay alive. And I've seen some absolute miracles. There's a few of them sitting around here. I can see that when I first saw them, they were at death's door. And so my job is quite rewarding. I might say again, we've never, like any AA group, we've consulted GSO and asked us to do something else other than send in our annual donation. Following the meeting here, we send in about $1 per head for everybody who came. That's roughly our general donation. We notified GSO of our activities, anything that comes up. But they've never suggested that they cared to have anything more than that. They've never suggested that we incorporate or draw up a set of bylaws or a constitution or anything of the sort. So we are really a loose-jointed outfit, and that sort of fits my personality. I'm loose-jointed and don't like to get things too well organized. I remember well Dr. Bob. I wasn't around and to hear his last talk. I have it on a scratchy record. And he impressed the phrase, keep it simple. And I've overdone it. I mean, I've kept it over simple. So long as I'm around, I'll try to keep it that way. It's reasonably simple. We try to keep a cross index, geographical cross index, and of course an alphabetical index, cross index by states. And we're in the process of a cross indexing for those who care to be called upon when another doctor in your area calls for help. We're setting that index up now. In other words, if Bob Smith's wife calls from Peoria and says, needs some help, have you got a doctor in our community that he can call? And my answer must and always has been and will always will be, I'll have someone call you. I'll never give out your names individually, and the list of people that I have are just over 2,000 address graph plates and have never been made up as a mailing list. Now, that's all the time they gave me, and that's about all I'm going to give you. So thank you all for coming. You've made this a fine meeting, and the committee, I'm sure, is delighted with the response. They go through all these labor pains in the last few days trying to figure out how many meals to order for Saturday night and how many for Thursday night and so on. They wonder whether they're going to be solvent or not, and they've done a great job, and I think we're going to break the barrier and be solvent when it's over, and this will be credible. There's one thing I almost forgot to ask, and I would like a showing of hands. We used to put together a list of those who need. In other words, the doctor's name, all the list is entitled is Cleveland, July 1981. This would be all it would be at the head of it, and it wouldn't be identified in any other way. But the name of the doctor, alphabetically, has been done. Many people like this. They like to have it for reference for Christmas cards or for whatever. And yet it is, in a way, it's an exposure of your, certainly if it's carelessly thrown around or gets tossed aside at your office, it identifies you purely as having been someplace on July 31st, 1981. Now, how many of you would like to have such a list prepared and it would be sent to just you? Am I looking at a majority?
Why ask for names? How many don't want?
How many would rather not? Thank you very much. I'm happy to be left in this position for this number of years. Anytime you get restless and want to get a new secretary treasurer, all you have to do is clamor up and we'll have an election. The steering committee meets at 4 o'clock upstairs. Steering committee is made up of representative chairman of each of the previous 7 years, the current secretary, the current host chairman, and the anticipated ones for the anticipated one for next year. Now, tentatively, it looks rather promising that we will go to Chicago. These folks in Chicago have a large and active group and have conducted meetings before. They've made a lot of inquiries, and they've asked us to consider Chicago for the next meeting. After we have a steering committee meeting today, we'll let you know where and when it'll be. Thank you all.
Thank you, Luke. Are we okay this year? We have to pass the hat? We're going to be all right. We're all right. We don't have to pass the hat this year. The only announcement I have, Jay, before he left, had commented to me that I think we're taking names or at least numbers of people that need a ride to the airport tomorrow. So if you'll check out the registration desk, if you need a ride to the airport, let us have an idea of numbers so we can make those arrangements. At this time, I'd like to introduce our next speaker. This is a guy who I've been saying hello to, he and his wife Margaret, for the past 4 or 5 years. Not last year, because I wasn't at last year's IDAA meeting. But the 3 years before that, I've been saying hello and chit-chatting and from time to time. And Luke had commented to me when we were preparing for this meeting that Michael and Margaret would be nice to have on the program. And I said, well, that's fine. That's good. Turns out Michael's on the program. Margaret's busy with needle and thread, so she's not on the program. And it's my pleasure to invite Michael H. to the podium to give his a talk, and it's a real pleasure for me because I didn't know that it was the guy that I've been saying hello to all these years. Michael?
Hi, everybody. My name is Michael Healy, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, for a long time, ever since I got into AA, when this happens to me, my mouth gets dry and my renal filtration triples. But I guess yours does, too. You know, my Irish mother didn't raise me to be an alcoholic. And I am CIA, Catholic, Irish, and alcoholic. And, you know, I thought of something last week which I hadn't thought, I'd never even remembered, but it came back to me. I was an altar boy in St. Lucie's Parish on the west side of Chicago, and I think I was 11 years old and I was serving 6:30 a.m. Mass. We had a good priest in that parish. I learned many years later that the bishop had moved him around from parish to parish and city to city, and finally retired him to his sister's home. And the reason was that he was an alcoholic. And in those days, there was no guest house. AA was probably early getting on in Chicago, and he had to live as an alcoholic. When he said Mass in the morning, he got there, he shook a lot. I thought it was because, you know, this is a very serious thing to say Mass. And I thought it was because he was so intent on what he was doing. After all, he was handling the body and blood of Christ. And after Mass, it was my job to open up the little lock. He could have broken it with a screwdriver easily, and get out the wine. And this priest told me to get out 3 bottles every morning. I didn't know why. I thought, you know, he's got a choice. Maybe he likes the light brown or the whatever. There was no drinking at our home. My father was an alcoholic. And when he was 29 years old, the Chicago Fire Department said, Pat, we don't like firemen drunk in the firehouse, and we want you before the Civil Service Board. And I remember the day that my father put on his uniform and went down there to beg for his job back. But before he did that, the Saturday before he did, he went to church and took the pledge. And there's actually a pledge in the Roman Breviary against alcohol, and he kept that pledge. At any rate, it's a tough way to stay sober. Any rate, this one day I put out the wine, and after Mass, Father F. finished off the bottle. So he left, and I thought, I wonder what that stuff is like. So I drank about a third of the next bottle and put them all away. And I remember feeling guilt, but that soon went away because I felt warm in here, and I felt a glow, and I almost danced all the way home. And you know, it isn't so important that I stole the wine and drank it. What's important is that I remember it so well. I didn't really start to drink until I was 17. Never forget that. Some of the older boys got their car from their father. We bought 4 quarts of beer, and I drank more than 1 quart of it. And I got home after 1 o'clock in the morning. The house was locked. I sneaked in the basement window, walked up those rickety wooden steps, and there was my father at the head of the stairs, and he slapped me so hard I thought I was going to go all the way down the stairs. My mother begged him not to hit me again. And that's the way it was with drinking, as I remember, early on. I choose to believe that I was an alcoholic from the very first drink. Matter of fact, I'm certain of it. I really never drank again with abandon. I'm not going to bore you with a long chronological drunkologue because, you know, one-upmanship in AA, you all have much better stories than I do. I didn't have a spectacular story. I never had a DWI. I never went to the hospital. I never was hospitalized because all of my drinking was controlled. Even when it was out of control, it was controlled. I only drank at home. I soon quit going to bars. I never drank at parties where anyone could really see me and see what happened to me when I did drink. I drank in the bedroom or in the study at home, and I really got with it. And it's a tough job. It takes more willpower than not drinking. I tried the not drinking one time in 1958. I was appointed chief of radiology at a Catholic hospital in Dallas. And I took a week's vacation. And when I got back from that vacation, I was the most hungover person in the whole world. And Sunday morning, a friend of mine who knew me very well, knew the nuns very well, knew what was involved very well, came by to see me, and I was drunk upstairs in the bedroom. And Jim came up, and he said, if those nuns find out that they're bright, young Irish Catholic radiologist is a drunk, you're through. And I had 5 and a half children, an ambitious wife with a checkbook, a new home, and I was scared to death. So I quit. And Jim told me, you know, you don't have to just quit and that's the end of it. He said, I know you can't do it by yourself. The one sad thing is he did not know about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, let you and I hit the communion rail every morning until you feel comfortable. He said, it's not going to hurt me. And he said, one more thing I'll do. I'm not going to drink until you feel comfortable not drinking. So we had almost the program, but not really. And so we hit the rail every morning, and 7 months later, Jim said, how about a break, you know? Is it okay if I quit coming every morning? And could I have a drink? And I said, yeah, Jim, I feel okay. But I never did. I was full of resentment, and I was full of self-pity, and I had all of my character defects right here, but I didn't drink. And I stayed that way until 1966, from 58 to 66. And in 1966, nothing different happened. I was promoted in the Navy, in the Naval Reserve, to commander. I had a lot of Marine Corps friends, a lot of Navy friends, so we had a wedding down party, and I was a bartender. I was always a bartender because I made good drinks. And I thought, God, it's been, you know, a long time since I had a drink. Surely I can have one tonight. I blacked out that night, and I had almost 2 pints of booze every night for 6 and a half months. And I thought I was going to die before I could get sober. I didn't know where to turn. I thought I was the only drunk doctor in the whole world. I didn't want anybody to find out. I was scared to death. I was nervous. I was unhappy. But I had one friend who was a real heavy drinker, and Rex and I had been in our residency together. You know, God rest his soul, he died at 42 of an overdose of Tolwyn. But I went to see Rex, and Rex didn't even know I was an alcoholic, didn't know I had a drinking problem, because all those years I hadn't ever had a drink. And I said, Rex, I'm scared to death to quit drinking. I'll get sick. I'll have convulsions. I could die. Plus the fact I just can't lay the bottle down. And so he thought for a while, and he said, I know how to help you. He said, why don't you take Antabuse, and I'll prescribe Librium, and that'll take the edge off. And I didn't quit taking Librium for 4.5 years. And you know, it was insidious. I didn't take 10 Librium a day at first. I took it exactly on doctor's orders. And later on, after that script ran out, I started writing it for myself. Never for myself, of course. I had lost a corpsman in my battalion when I was a battalion surgeon in Korea. And I remembered his name. And I used his name. And I knew I'd never get caught. He was dead. And so I'd order for J.J. Walsh, and then I'd show up as J.J. Walsh. And I got Librium and Valium and Placidil, because very soon I got a high tolerance to these drugs, and I couldn't sleep. But I could sleep with 2-Placidil, 2-Doridin, chloral hydrate. I looked up all of them, and I used all of them. I even used Valmid. Does anybody remember Valmid? At any rate, the last couple of months, I used to think it was the last couple of weeks of my abuse. The last couple of months of my abuse, I found Valium. And thank God I really didn't get into high-dose, long-term Valium, or I might not be here. I went to AA in 1968 because I'd sent a doctor off to treatment, a good friend of mine. We used to drink together. And God, he was a bad alcoholic. I had a light case, but Lou was sick. You know, he'd lost his job and his wife and his home. And I read about it in the newspaper. I hadn't seen him for a few years. And I went by his home. I didn't know that across the street were a couple of drug agents that were taking down license plates, you know, to see who came to this guy's home. Because he was not only using them himself, he was giving them to his buddies. He was making LSD in a lab. And he was shooting Ritalin. I went in, and Lou was in. The only piece of furniture in the whole place was a rocking chair, and he was sitting in it, and he was eating cornflakes. That was all that was left in the house. The cockroaches and his wife got everything else. I said, Lou, where are all your friends? And he said, they're staying away in huge negative droves. And they were. Nobody came to see Lou, so we talked for a while, and I called Austin Ripley, whom I'd met several years before, and said, you know, Rip, I don't know where you send drunks, but I know you're doing real well with them at Guest House. What can I do with them? And he said, Michael, I've got several priests on the waiting list, and some of them are going to die before they get here. I just don't have any room, but I'll find a place for them. And he did. And this man had no money. I didn't have any that I could spare. Nobody had any money. And some real great guys in Nashville, Tennessee took Lou and kept him for 6 months and the whole bit. And Lou went through all kinds of hell. But while he was making his adjustment to Alcoholics Anonymous, while he was getting in, he called me one night and he said, why don't you come to AA with me? And I said, Lou, I can't go there. What if people find out that or see me there? You know, they'll think I'm a drunk. And Lou was a good, conning alcoholic. He said, they'll never find out. He said, you know, you're a nice young doctor and you dress up in your good clothes. And he said, I'll just tell them you're here to study the disease. And I was so phony, I bought it. So I went to a meeting, and, you know, I liked it. I had no idea what AA was all about. If I saw an article on Alcoholics Anonymous in a magazine, book, newspaper, I quickly went by it. If there was an article on the disease of alcoholism in a journal, I never read it. I acted like it wasn't there. I didn't want to know about it. I was afraid that I might be one. And like many, many people and most doctors, I thought it was a personal moral problem, and I probably had it, and I didn't want to have that moral problem. I was a terrible judge of alcoholics. I didn't like drunks. Didn't like to be around them. I thought there was no hope for it, and I thought it was a terrible way to go. I went to that meeting, and at the back door was a Town North group of Alcoholics Anonymous, at 5050 Lover's Lane in Dallas. And, you know, I went there, and there was a guy with a big beard in the back. And when I walked in, he shook hands and said, "My name is Bud Kemp, and I know where you've been." And I spent the whole meeting wondering how he knew where I'd been. You know, those people were smiling, and their conception of what drunks were. I thought it'd be a terrible step down for me to join a group of drunks. There were smart people there. We had two millionaires in that group at the time staying sober, and that's a record because it's tough for a rich man to stay sober. There were women there. Everybody was clean and sober and happy. There were a couple of girls there that used some Navy tough talk, swearing. And I've always been fascinated by women that knew how to swear. And I liked the whole deal. I felt comfortable. And so I came back a few times. And I always had Librium in my pocket. And I had the other stuff at home. And I was unable to see myself. I didn't know that those nice clothes and that Cadillac I was driving up in and that neat title I had as a doctor were all really kind of phony. I didn't realize that I was on the verge of financial bankruptcy, emotional bankruptcy, that my marriage was about to break and eventually did break, that my children were afraid of me. I'd never raised my hand to my children. My father never did to my sisters, and I had six girls and a boy. By this time, my boy was bigger than me anyway, and I never did raise my hand to my children. But they were afraid. They didn't know what was Daddy going to do? What's going to happen tonight? My wife, who really kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. Our only communication was anger and resentment. And we played sick tennis all the time. You did this. No, you did that. And we got real good at it. I stayed in shape playing sick tennis. And I went, and I realized that this is a great program. These people have something. I wonder what it is. And I kept taking drugs, and the dose went up, and I went to fewer meetings, and I dropped out. And I got sicker and sicker. And the marriage did break. We're in the process of a divorce. I almost went bankrupt. I kept getting letters. You know those window letters in a brown envelope from the Internal Revenue Service? And they were so nasty, I quit opening them. And I never did do anything really wrong. I was afraid to break the law, and I knew the power of the United States government, so I always sent in my tax returns on time, done by an accountant, no checks. If there's anybody in that shape, after the meeting, I'll tell you how long it takes them to really nail you to the wall. Because I waited till the last minute. And, you know, I was living in a little apartment, and I was lonely and sad. I'd met a real great guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He just celebrated 34 years of continuous sobriety 2 months ago. And I had mistakenly asked Bill to be my sponsor, and he never let go. Even when I was out there, he'd call me and ask me to lunch, and he was kind to me. He never confronted me, but that's just the way he felt, and that was okay. He was very kind to me, and when I needed him, I remembered the kindness, and maybe that's the way God ordained it. I'm sure it's the way God ordained it. If he'd been tough with me, I may not have come back. Margaret and I knew each other by then, and Margaret kept finding a lot of medicine around the house. We were living together. We couldn't get married. The divorce was going on forever. Margaret would ask me, "What are these black and green medicines that you have in your pocket?" And I'd say, "Those are samples." And then I said, "Those are for patients." And she knew better, but she really didn't know better. And Margaret called ambulances because I wasn't breathing good. And Margaret, at first, made great excuses, you know. Her lover, her great friend, would be in the middle of a big story and fall asleep. She thought, the poor man, he works too hard. I'm not going to tell her story, but things got worse and worse and worse. And Margaret has a beautiful story about finding Al-Anon. and she started to go to Al-Anon, and she didn't ask me about the pills anymore. And she didn't take my pulse all the time. And she didn't ask me, how come you go in the bathroom with a glass of milk and come out and collapse? She quit bugging me, and she really didn't really bug me very much to begin with, but she just quit. And she got more calm, and she didn't have that worried look on her face, and she was going to Al-Anon. And on July 9th of 1971, Margaret had gone to a meeting. I was there in the apartment alone, lonely, in the pits. I didn't know what to do about the IRS. I didn't know how I was going to face this many, many appearances in court. I didn't know how I was going to hold my medical practice together and continue to face doctors because I was a shell. For some reason, all those tranquilizers and sedatives made me lose a fantastic amount of weight. I weighed about 120 pounds. I was skin and bone. I was drawn, nutritionally deficient. I was a total mess. And I thought, what's going to happen to me? And I got more and more scared. My pulse went up, and I got pains in my chest. I didn't know what to do. And I remembered those people that I'd met at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, they've got an answer. And, you know, all this time, I knew that God was really there. The God I'd learned in the Catholic Church from the nuns and the priests somehow was a punishing God. That's not the way he's really presented, I don't think, in the Catholic Church, but that's the way I got him. And I thought, maybe he wears red clothes and has a big shepherd's crook and speaks with an Italian accent, and he doesn't hear me anyway. He's too busy with the race problem, with the Vietnam War, and with world hunger. Why is he going to listen to me? But I had no place else to turn, so I got down on my knees, and I asked God for help. While I was on my knees, no lights went off. There was no bolt of lightning, but I felt good on my knees. I hadn't been on my knees, as I can remember, in a long, long time. Months, years, probably. And I really meant it, and I felt like I was talking to a real presence. And I said, I need your help desperately. You know it, and now I know it. And I've got to have help. And, you know, I think that the first three steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous happened to me. I think they came as a gift from God, right there. When I got up, I suddenly knew, without even thinking about it, I've got to get rid of all the medication. And God, I had a lot of medication to get rid of. I had it in cuffs of trousers. I had it in vest pockets. Margaret's a great housekeeper, but it was under the corners of rugs. One time the dog ate a half a pound of marijuana, and just kind of goofy, you know, but she even liked the seeds. It was all over that apartment. I got it all, and I dumped it. And it never occurred to me that you don't come off that kind of high-dose medication and expect to just sail along. I knew nothing about withdrawal, really. And it did occur to me, I wonder if I'm going to be able to sleep now that I have nothing to help me to sleep. But I never thought about taking a pill. As soon as I got off my knees, that was an invalid alternative to take anything. Now I had to get better. And I threw it all away. I flushed it down to John. And I hope they don't recycle that water, because a lot of people went to sleep. And, you know, I'll tell you about the withdrawal. I must have a hell of a high tolerance for convulsions, or a hell of a high convulsive point, because I didn't have any. I didn't sleep for 7.5 weeks, and I know it exactly to the date and time. I slept in snatches. I'd wake wide awake, and I'd get real sleepy in the car on the way to work. Or I'd get real sleepy at dinner time, but I never did sleep really at night. I learned the value of hot baths to help you sleep. Stay in as long as I possibly could, because they went home to sleep and I went home to sit in the corner or to stare at the ceiling. But they told me at Alcoholics Anonymous, it's going to get better. Nobody ever, if I ever heard that, I heard it 100,000 times, and if I heard it one more time, I was going to kill the one that said it. Nobody ever died from lack of sleep. Well, sometimes you'd wish you'd die just to get a little rest. But I guess nobody ever had. And then it dawned on me that every minute, not hour or not 24 hours, but every minute that I was away from that medication, I was getting better. And one day, my brain would recover and it'd all come back okay. So when I got real bad, I said, you know, I've got a couple more minutes, or I've got 3 hours, 10 days now. Anyway, I knew where I had to go. I knew who had the answer, and I wasn't afraid of you. So it all wasn't lost. You know, that early exposure to AA was no loss at all. I don't think it since. And I knew exactly where to go, so I called up Bill, and I said, Bill, I'm coming to a meeting tonight. And he said, good. So I went, and they were glad to see me, but sort of looked at me with a jaundiced eye. And they told me in the next couple of days, look, we know you're getting better now, but we want to tell you a few things. First of all, leave the stethoscope and the white coat outside. You need us a lot more than we need you. And don't tell us about your degrees. You've been going crazy by degrees. And don't tell us what's wrong with us. There's too much wrong with you. And you can not talk in here till we tell you you can talk. And you got to be at a meeting every single night for 90 days. And when it's over, we'll tell you how long more you got to go every night. And don't let anybody call you doctor. Now, you know, you can't go to AA and hide the fact that you're a doctor. They know almost, you know, by feel. They know the doctors that are coming in. But you don't have to play doctor. You know, it was easy for me. I overheard somebody say several weeks later, don't ask him, he's not even a real doctor. I resented it, but you know, it was true. Plus the fact, I've never written a prescription for an alcoholic. I've always told him the danger of pills. And even though I wanted to give a good, hairy-chested, macho talk about breaking the necks off fifths and drinking it down glass and all, I had to tell, you know, the story about pills. It's a girl's habit. I didn't like it. You know, there isn't a pill made that's as good as a shot of booze. But, you know, pills almost killed me, and pills kill a lot of my friends. So I had to throw it in. And I always talk about it whenever I get up and talk. And so I started coming and I started listening, and it was an oasis in the desert. The IRS didn't let up. The divorce kept on going. My bankruptcy or near bankruptcy kept going. Everything was bad. I was only 5 years behind in my chosen specialty. I didn't go to a single CME. I never read a radiology article. I was too busy worrying, taking pills or drinking. I was way behind. I was far beyond the half-life of my education, but I was sober. I was going to AA, and the heat was off. I thought they were kind of lighthearted about all of my damn problems, you know. But, you know, you don't understand. And they'd say, yeah, we do. It'll get better. And so finally I got a couple of them together, and I said, look, the IRS has put a sign on the front door where my ex-wife and kids live, and it says, don't take this sign down, you know. This place is being held for taxes or whatever they say. Hope you never read it. Can't take it down. And the last guy that called me said, we're going to sell your cars and we're going to go to each one of your patients and collect what they owe. Now, you know, radiologists have thousands of patients out there that don't know us and we don't know them. And it's nickel and dime stuff. And I just couldn't see these guys in shabby clothes and sweaty collars going demanding the money. So I said, what am I going to do? And they said, well, your life is unmanageable. Why don't you get a manager for all this? So I got a small, cigar-chewing Mick lawyer and an ex-IRS agent accountant, and they went. And they sat me at one end of a long table, and they and the head agent in Dallas sat at this end, and they divided my clothes. And so, you know, the agent said, pointedly, Mr. Healy, they never call you doctor in this game. Write out a budget that you can live on, a monthly budget. So, you know, I wrote it down, and for odds and ends, and, you know, my high-rolling ambitions, and I figured about $1,500 a month tax-free I could live, apartment, whatever else, and they gave me 4 1/4. And then they gave my ex-wife money for the kids and her, they paid for the house, and they took the rest. And that went on for 2.5, I think 3 years. And the divorce went through. Oh, by the way, none of this bothered me. I was sober, I was going to meetings, I was reading the big book, and I had all kinds of friends, and they loved me. I gotta tell you one thing. Even though I had come into AA, by the way, when I first came into AA, after about 2 weeks, I signed a card at the Town North Group. And you know, we're very fortunate in Dallas. We have clubhouses and regular places to meet and many meetings. And they keep a record of the members, you know, Michael H. and my sobriety date. It was sometime in 67. And I went back to AA and I went to a few meetings and it came time to get truthful. And you know, it bothered me to go back there and write out a new card. That's got to be the height of some kind of arrogance and self-centeredness and egotism. I'd never been sober all that time. And I did. And then here comes the time. You know, in Texas, we always give our sobriety date. And one time I came back from Chicago and told Bill, "Hey, Bill, in Chicago, they don't give sobriety dates. As a matter of fact, they look at you funny if you do." He said, "Maybe they don't have any." So anyway, one way to get around that, of course, I did this the first couple of closed meetings, discussion meetings. My name is Michael, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober today. And it works, but I knew it was going to catch up with me, so one day it broke my heart, but I said, "My name is Michael, I'm an alcoholic, I've been sober 8 days today." And they hugged me, and they kissed me, and they said, "Thank God. We thought you were going to die." And then they started telling me little inside stuff. And, you know, there's all kinds of inside stuff in AA. And they started telling me, you know, "We're worried about doctors. We've had a lot of doctors come here and learn all about it, get the lingo, and leave. And in case you don't know what happens to the people that don't come to meetings, keep coming to meetings and you'll find out what happens to the people that don't come to meetings." And, of course, I had no choice. I was on that 90-day gig, and I was coming anyway. And later on, I found out what happens to people that don't come to meetings. They get drunk and they die. It's that simple. And I said, "How can I avoid that, you know?" And they said, "You got a lot to learn, but one thing, you're nothing special." They said, "You know, it's a bad thing to feel like you're nothing. That's a bad place for a man to be because he's a child of God. And it's real bad for us as egotists to feel like we're something special. But it's perfect to feel like you're nothing special." And you know, I began to feel I'm nothing special. And I came and I practiced some of the stuff I saw them doing. I picked up the lingo. I got the one day at a time, easy does it. Later on I learned that "let go, let God" has two superfluous words in it. If you let go, he's got it anyway. And so I just started telling myself, "Let go." And very shortly, when we started talking about God, and in AA in Dallas, Texas, they talk about God unashamedly. And they said, "You'll be better when you can talk about God as if you really believed he's right there." And I really wanted to do that. And I began to talk about God. I began to practice it there. And I told some of them about, you know, God being sort of a fearful person who lived in Rome. Not really, but, you know, he probably does. And I never could get with him. I felt like he was too busy, or I don't know what I felt like. I just never really tried. And they said, "You know, this is really easy. The second step is one of the neatest steps. The first three steps are just a change of attitude. You don't have to do anything. Just change your attitude." And I said, "Well, what should I think about God?" And they said, "Go home tonight and write down everything you want God to be. Everything you want God to be." And I did. He's got to be all-powerful and magnificent and beautiful. And the last thing I got to, he ought to be a loving father who would take care of me as his child, not particularly his son, his child. I've made a lot of mistakes in my life. I've done things I wasn't proud of. and as a loving father, he'd forgive me. And I wrote those things down beside each attribute I gave him, and that was my God, and I folded it up and put it in my wallet and kept it. And with that kind of a God, I could talk to him. And I never called him Dad, but I started calling him Father. And he really did respond. Never in words, he responded through you. And when you told me, look, nothing can hurt you as long as you're sober, as long as you have a higher power, and you already call him God, and as long as you're faithful to this program and give of yourself, nothing can hurt you. The IRS, the bankruptcy court, whoever. The same lawyer who snatched me back from the IRS said, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate for you to go bankrupt, even though you're a bankrupt. We'll try to fix you up. So they did. And they wrote everybody and said, you know, this fella hasn't been well. But he's getting better now. And if you want to speak to him personally, he'll come and tell you what was wrong. And he'll tell you what he's doing about getting better. And he's going to pay you in the following way. And they listed it out. If it was a small amount, it's $1 a week until he can go higher. And that really offended my high-rolling personality. $1 a week? Let's send him 100 so I'd look good. No, it's $1 a week. And that included Neiman Marcus. There was one bill in there. My wife played a funny game with me. When we were getting divorced, she went to all the places we had credit cards and charged everything. And there's a beautiful lady shop in Dallas called the Carriage Shop, and I got this huge bill from, and I thought, a carriage shop? We don't have a carriage. We got an automobile. Margaret told me where it was. Somehow we escaped the resentment, the two of us, over she's getting all the money. She hates me, the poor girl. She does. She's teaching the children I'm a bad guy, and she's getting all the money. I think it came up twice, and both of us realized it's futile to even talk about it. Forget it. It's going to get over one of these days. So then the divorce was final, and Margaret and I were drawing close together. Margaret says in her talk, and God, when I thought back of it, she's right. She doesn't remember my coming into the program, except suddenly I was there, because she was busy with herself. And there were strong Al-Anons. And Margaret's first sponsor was an AA woman who loved both of us very much. And Margaret was going to Al-Anon, and I was going to AA, and she'd stay away from me, and I'd stay away from her. And we stayed after the meeting, and we talked to people, and we started doing a lot of things that were positively healing for us. We stayed late after the meetings. We went to conferences and conventions, and we went to people's homes, and we listened to tapes. You don't have to do all that, but God, it makes it incredibly easier to get this program. Just jump all the way in, way over your head, and come out beautiful. And they guarantee it. And I had nowhere else to go anyway. I was afraid to answer the telephone up till then. I was afraid to answer the door, and I didn't open my mail. And suddenly things started perking up. And, you know, those conventions, some of them are in great places. There was one in northern Arkansas one time, and the dogwood was in bloom, and there must have been 3,000 people up there, and there was no hotel rooms left, and we got a little dinky room, and they talked straight AA, and they were unafraid to talk about God and how God can heal your life. And the whole place was beautiful, and it was better than a European vacation. And we loved it. We went to all the Texas conventions. We got very, very close to some of the AA families that had us into their homes and talked to us. We moved out of an apartment. We rented a house. And suddenly it came time for us to get married. And Margaret grew up in Germany. And it dawned on me one day on the way home, wouldn't it be neat to go back to Germany where Margaret grew up and get married there? And I was having all kinds of thoughts like that. I mentioned this at a couple's meeting last night. The first couple of years of sobriety, I'd suddenly get a thought out of the clear blue sky. I think I'll buy Margaret some flowers. And God, that felt good. I don't know how she felt about it, really, but it made me feel great. And I do it. And it, what does it cost? A couple of bucks? And getting little things for Margaret just to show her I really appreciated her felt good. And this sounded like the best thing I had thought about in years. And so I went to this tough, cigar-chewing accountant, and I said, Joe, I need enough money for the two of us to go to Germany and get married and come back. And he said, you're still crazy. And I said, Joe, for God's sake, I've been working a year and a half. I've never made so much money in my life. It's all falling together. They're getting it all. But I really need a vacation. And he said, well, I don't think you can go all the way to Europe for a vacation. I said, Joe, if I don't get a vacation, I'm liable to break down. And I think if you tell that IRS agent to consider the alternatives, he said, okay, you can go. So we got all our stuff together, and Margaret suddenly remembered what Germany is really like. We can't go there unmarried and expect them to approve the paperwork. It would have taken 6 months. The Germans love paperwork. So we went downtown in Dallas and got married by a little black gal in the Justice of the Peace office in Dallas. So we went there married. We got married in a very old church that remained untouched by the bombing of Berlin, which was terribly bombed. And this place is in Tempelhof, and we got married there. We had a typical German wedding. We had the Polterabend the night before, where everybody comes and breaks the dishes, and everybody drank wine. None of the family knew alcoholism. And Margaret told him, Michael doesn't drink. And later her father said he could have a beer. She said, no, he doesn't drink anything. Now they know. I got a huge German family for nothing. You know? Here I am, a stranger, an Amerikanischer, and I show up in Germany, and because I married their daughter, I'm in the family. And it's neat. We got married in that church. We had an American minister who took his father's place in a Lutheran church in Berlin. So he had it in English and in German. And we rode to church in a white Mercedes with flowers all over it. I've never been happier in my life. And AA did it all. Going there drunk would have been impossible. Thinking about it drunk would have been impossible. And then when it came time for a honeymoon, not only did Margaret and I go on our honeymoon to Bavaria, they all came. Her parents, her brother and sister-in-law, her other brother, his girlfriend, we all went to Bavaria, to a German resort. We skied, we fooled around, we had a lot of fun. I never thought about drinking. I never thought about pills. I was so glad that that was no longer part of my life that I thank God daily. I had a lot of gratitude. I still have a lot of gratitude. AA saved my life. We came back from Germany. Oh, by the way, we did come back from Germany. Now, remember, I'm a Roman Catholic, and you know the church frowns on Roman Catholics being out there somewhere. And I had been divorced, and so I really wasn't in the church. So I went to see a Jesuit priest who was a friend of mine. I said, what am I going to do? You know, I feel badly because I'm outside the church, just like I felt badly when I went to AA with pills in my pocket. It was like looking through plate glass. All of you folks are doing okay, and something's between me and God and you. And now I feel out of the Catholic Church. And you know, this is not a blanket permission for everybody, but you know what he told me? He said, you know, the Catholic Church has been tough on the people in it. And he said, you now see God as a loving Father. And if God, your loving Father, had a banquet, would he tell you you can't come? And I said, I don't think he would. He said, okay, make up your own mind. So Margaret and I started going to Mass. He said, just don't let your kids see you together at church, even though we were married now. He said, don't give scandal. They know you're not in. So we went to churches way out here somewhere, and both of us received communion, and we felt good about it. We didn't go every Sunday, even though it's a requirement. We went because not because it was required. And lo and behold, Margaret started taking instructions in the Catholic Church and became a Catholic, and we were married a third time. We weren't really married a third time. That Lutheran marriage is approved by the Catholic Church, of course, and was just blessed. And my little Irish mother was there, and it was right around St. Patrick's Day, and it was neat. Margaret asked me not too long ago, this about every 2 years, do you think we're going to too much AA? And, you know, she's not the only initiator of this. I've asked myself, am I going to too much AA? And I always think, what's the alternative? So I keep going. And, you know, I don't want to brag or make it a big deal because my life is at stake. I go at least 5 times a week. at least. Joy and a privilege to find AA and go to AA there. We went to San Francisco and to see San Francisco and went to AA. We've gone all over the United States. We've been to AA in Germany. By the way, we got hooked on Germany, and we've been there, I think, six times since. 2 years ago, we got back to Ireland. It was my first visit. I felt like I was coming home, just like every other Irish yank. You know, God, look at that gorgeous little country, and it's mine. And you know, the Irish, because they can't help it, and because they got so many Irish yanks coming back telling them how Irish they are, they tend to stick to themselves, and they tend not to get too excited because you're Irish, too. Everybody's Irish. And the Irish are, they're happy people. They live in an antique country. They're beautiful people. My nephew was there. He's now about to go to medical school. When he came back, he wrote me a letter, and he said, you know, I hope you get to Ireland real soon. The people are more beautiful than the country. And he's right. They're up to here in alcoholism, but they're beautiful. So you know how we got into the hearts and the homes of the Irish people, which I really wanted to do if I could? We went to AA. Went to AA in rural Ireland, where it's tough for them to go to AA. Once you walk in the door of AA, you're labeled. A woman told me, a sweet woman, a beautiful woman, she said, you know, it was a little bit tough at first, because it's okay to be drunk in a pub, but if a woman goes to AA, she's a slut. And I said, do you feel like a slut? And she said, oh, God, no. I'm grateful to God for AA. And you know that little Irish town where my mother grew up, it's Abbeyfield, County Kerry. And they have three physicians in that town, and they're all drunks. All three of them. You know, they're fairly good doctors. They just get drunk a lot. And you know, the little shawlies at church with the shawls over their head will say, did you see Dr. Rooney this morning? Yes. He's the best doctor in this whole place. Drunk or sober, he's the best doctor in this place. They say the same thing about the priest. Drunk or sober, he gives the best sermon of any priest. We went to lots of AA. We had plans to go to Dublin. We canceled them. We stuck around that part of Kerry. We went to Listowel, went to Castle Island. We met a doctor who was 2 months sober in the program, going right in his hometown. It took courage. It took dedication, and he was grateful to God for it. We love to go to AA and other places. I was 5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said to my sponsor, somebody turned my name into an outfit called IDAA. He said, what does it mean? I said, it means International Doctors in AA. And I'd kind of like to go to it. He said, I don't know if that's okay or not, you know. And I said, come on, Bill, I've been sober 5 years. Margaret and I like to go. It's in a nice city. And he said, well, he said, go, but if they ask you how to stay sober, tell them it's AA. None of you asked me. I got back to Dallas and I said, my God, Bill, it's an AA meeting. You know, they're just like everybody else. They're grateful to God to be sober. They're talking about God in their lives. Their loved ones go to Al-Anon. And, you know, he was delighted. And so I got into IDAA. And this IDAA is frosting on my AA cake. Honest to God, it is. I wouldn't miss them for any reason except lack of money or terrible illness. I have to be here. I've got all kinds of friends in this room, and I don't see you for another 6 months, but I'm delighted to see you. You're part of my life. You're part of my recovery. You know, many beautiful things have happened to me. One of the earliest things that happened to me, and I can't tell you how grateful I am for this, was enthusiasm for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Paul said it so beautifully. You know, he broke down the word enthusiasm. Inside godliness, or whatever he said. But it's got God in it, and it's inside. And I'll tell you, the best AAs are enthusiastic AAs. And the best AA doctors, the happiest AA doctors, are enthusiastic AA doctors. And I started to hear in AA, somebody would say, my doctor has got a problem. I smell booze on his breath. I understand he can't go to St. Paul Hospital anymore. and the first thing that came to my mind, for God's sake, who is he? Who is your doctor? And the reason I said that was a friend of mine in California said, don't wait for the doctors to call. They'll die first. You know, did Bill Wilson wait for Bob Smith to call him? Bill, I used to think that Bill called one minister and got Helen Cyberling and got Bob. It was the 10th minister, I understand. Was it, Luke? Number 10. He had to tell that story to 10 different guys before he got one minister that clicked. And that took faith and trust in God, and it kept him from taking a drink. And I thought, I'm never going to wait till somebody calls in and says, hey, there's a doctor on the line that needs help. If I hear of him, I'm going to go see him. So I started going out to talk to doctors long before we had an impaired physicians committee in Dallas, long before I knew about the impaired physicians program. I went to the very first impaired physicians conference in San Francisco, and I was absolutely delighted. Suddenly, people are beginning to realize that we almost seem to prefer to die before we'll get well, and we've got to outreach to these people. And we're not promoting. Besides, attraction rather than promotion has to do with our public relations policy, not AA. If a guy is dying out there, for God's sake, go and tell him there's hope. If he throws you out, it's okay. I've never gotten hurt on a 12-step call. I've taken 2 loaded pistols away from people. I've been threatened, but never hurt. It's God's business. You'll never get hurt. You know, 2.5 years ago, they formed an impaired physicians committee. And I thought, you know, you're supposed to be asked for these committees. And I thought, I'm going to go down there and promote myself onto it. And I got down and I was about to say what I wanted to say. And the executive director said, by the way, we've just appointed you to a committee. And that was it. And I was grateful to God. We're very conservative in Dallas. They appointed 4 non-alcoholics and 2 alcoholics. But we outnumbered them. We realized we got to teach them. We got to talk about AA being the recovery program. A guy and a gal on this committee are psychiatrists. Every time we see a doctor in that committee, they talk about depression. Are you in therapy, doctor? And, you know, we were polite. We almost polited ourselves right out of a committee. But later we thought, the hell with it. Let's tell them. So every time therapy comes up, we say, the therapy for alcoholism and drug abuse is specific, and it's AA. Of course he's in therapy. And we soon learned that it wasn't enough to depend on that committee or to depend on that committee to go help the doctor. And about a little over 2 years ago, we formed a Wednesday night group of impaired physicians trying to get better. It started with 2 people, and it's over 30. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, there was one other doctor in Dallas, Texas, going to AA, and he was in the east side of town, and I saw him twice a year. Now I see my doctor friends every Wednesday night, and it's an alive committee. And we don't go individually to see a sick doctor. We go in groups of 2. Now, our impaired physicians committee also wants to do that, and that's fine. Always a recovering doctor and a new one. And I went with our new psychiatrist one time, and on the way to see Ernie, who's a great member of our Wednesday group and is sober in AA, he said, you know, I've never talked to a real sick alcoholic doctor, and I'm scared. And I said, that's okay, Mark. You know, they're not too bad to talk to. He's more scared than we are. And he said, I know one of the things in confrontation is to have a bad guy and a good guy. Would you be the bad guy? And I said, well, it's foreign to me. I said, okay, I'll be the bad guy. And you know, I've never gotten out of the bad guy deal since. And Ernie made it. And Ernie's in the program. And thank God for Ernie. And so that committee gets the names of the doctors from a variety of places. And our Wednesday night group is a place to get well. It's not a substitute for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never forget one night somebody said in that meeting, if this is substituting for Alcoholics Anonymous, I know where there's a better meeting on Wednesday night. And I feel exactly that way. If that's the only meeting I could go to because I'm a doctor, I'd leave. I'd go back to civilian status and get well. Some of our doctors use it that way, and they're the sad-looking ones who wonder, why isn't my marriage straightening out? Why am I no longer happy in the practice of medicine? Why am I full of anxiety? And we tell them, you got to go to AA. Now, we use that because since we're a bunch of con artists anyway, if we get a doctor who says, look, I can't go to that problem. I'm in therapy with my psychiatrist, and we're going to a marriage counselor. This is a typical story. My kids have no problems. They never talk. They have no problems. I think somebody's burning the cellophane upstairs, but there are no problems with my kids. But I can't go to that AA because somebody will see me. We say, hey, we got a group of doctors who've had this problem, and they're all getting well, and it's not AA, because you see, it really isn't AA. We get them in, and we say, look, this is... And then we hope that the members of AA in that group will be living examples, just like it is in AA. If we've got winners on Wednesday night, they'll see. They're alcoholics. They'll know. We quickly learned that we had about one-third straight Demerol addicts. And you know, if you're a Demerol addict and you go to a regular tough love AA group, there's going to be an old guy in the back that says, addicts don't belong here. In order to avoid that, since every addict is an alcoholic anyway, we tell all our new guys, when you go to this double A, you say, my name is Bill, I'm an alcoholic addict, and you're safe. They'll accept you. And it's worked. Nobody's thrown anybody out. And I used to think that addicts were bad guys, because I never was one, number one. And number two, everybody knows that addicts sell their sisters for dope. And I felt that way until I met one and got to know him and was in a meeting with him and hugged him. They're exactly like us. They're exactly like us. The disease is the same, and they get well like us in Alcoholics Anonymous. NA has not been working too well in Dallas. That's no indictment of NA. For the doctors, somehow, it's a little bit too much finger snapping, rock and roll music, and short sobriety. And they just haven't really fitted. Maybe they'll form their own. But the point is, AA works for them, and we're telling them all the time. I've been deeply privileged to be able to intervene in many doctors. It's a privilege to me. It keeps me sober. It keeps me very enthusiastic about this program. Just recently, I was appointed to the state committee, which is, you know, it meets in Austin 3 times a year. Texas is so damn big, if they told us there was a guy in El Paso dying of alcoholism, he'd be buried and have his name in the paper before we could get there. We're starting to get organized. We're finding more of us around the state, and phone calls are easy. And we've got a network, just like AA always had anyway. And you know, most of our doctors are beginning to realize they don't have to be special. They don't have to be something better. They can be regular, honest-to-God people, and they can come to Alcoholics Anonymous and get well. And, you know, thank God for that.
Thank you, Michael. That was an excellent lead. I'm not real good at being analytical and going through a guy's lead and telling him about the high points. I just can't do it. It was excellent. I enjoyed it, and I know everybody else did. We're supposed to have a movie on our brother's keeper. And I don't see a projector, which I would expect to see when we're going to have a movie. I see a projector. We're going to have a movie.